Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. There's a curious entertainment phenomenon that occurs during the holidays. In addition to the usual holiday fare, there's an opposing force that seems to develop against the treacly sweet and heartwarming nature of most Christmas-themed books, movies, theater, and television. And that force reminds us that the world is not always a nice and sweet place, and the Christmas spirit, at best, is brief and fleeting. My guest today is the editor of a collection that seems to embody those thoughts, but he says, hold on, no, there's more to it than that. John Woolley is the host of Public Radio's Swing on This and is a specialist on a wide variety of esoterica, from drive-ins and horror films to Oklahoma music and pulp fiction, especially the hard-boiled detective writers like Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett. He and his co-editor John McMahon have published a holiday collection titled Hard-Boiled Christmas Stories, featuring an original story by Woolley along with Christmas-themed stories by many of the writers that wrote pulp fiction in the 20s and 30s. It's gritty, dirty, and yet there is always the beam of hope at the end of each story. John Woolley joins us today here on Studio Tulsa. John Woolley, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
I have to tell you, you probably have one of the most unusual offerings for the holiday season I've ever thought about. It's a series of stories from the pulp fiction guys, the hard-boiled detectives. Now, you wear many hats, everything from a specialist on Western swing to horror films to Oklahoma music, but another passion of yours is that old pulp fiction.
I love pulp fiction, yes.
And there's an interesting line at the very beginning of Hard-Boiled Christmas Stories: scratch a cynic and you'll find a romantic. And that sort of symbolizes the holiday season, doesn't it?
It does for us. And it also does for the hardboiled detective because, you know, hardboiled detectives talk tough and they're cynical, and they're only cynical because they care enough to be cynical. If you really don't care anything about anything, you're not cynical at all because it just doesn't disturb you. But people like Philip Marlowe, Raymond Chandler's Philip Marlowe, for instance, was very cynical about the mean streets but really underneath it all, he is he's a symbol of hope. And that's what these detectives are all about.
Now, is there a difference between pulp fiction and like the hard-boiled detective?
Hard-boiled detectives came out of the pulps. Back in the 1920s, actually, was when the hard-boiled detective was really born in a pulp magazine called Black Mask. But the pulps, for those who don't know, at one time, that was the biggest source of reading material for people in the country, blue-collar, basically, reading material.
Would it be like the National Enquirer today, sort of at the checkout stand at the grocery store?
It would be more like those series of, like, The Destroyer, The Executioner, all of those paperback series that they had in the 80s that people read, that action fiction.
So it would be in the supermarket. It might be on one of those little carousels.
Absolutely. It would be on newsstands back then, of course, and it would have been prominently, and the covers were very lurid and very garish. They sort of just bloomed like orchids on those old newsstands in the 30s and 40s.
And, of course, illustrations was a big part of that a lot, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And one of the things on Hardboiled Christmas Stories we're real happy to have is David Saunders painted our cover. His father was Norm Saunders, and Norman Saunders, in addition, people who collect bubblegum cards know Mars Attacks, they know Wacky Packs. He did those, but he was also one of the few primary pulp cover artists in the golden age of the 30s and 40s.
And you're able to use his illustrations? And did you have original illustrations?
We have original illustrations inside. David did the cover for us. Norman Saunders' son, David, did the cover for us and also did a couple of new illustrations for the story that I wrote in the style of an old pulp writer named Robert Leslie Bellum. And then we reprinted some other illustrations from the original pulp.
Now, one of the things your collection does, it tells the story of all these writers, it's pretty nebulous. It's hard to say, you know, and who knows if you were dealing with pseudonyms in some cases.
That's right. That's exactly right. A lot of house names in the pulps because those guys had to be so prolific, Rich. A lot of times they were getting a half cent or a cent a word. And so you had to really turn out the copy if you wanted to make a good living. And a lot of people did, but they turned out a lot of it.
Now, one that you've been involved with is the stories of Robert Leslie Bellum, which you mentioned, the Dan Turner. You actually, I think, wrote a screenplay for a film.
In 1990, some people may remember, we shot a Dan Turner Hollywood detective made for TV film with Mark Singer, the Beastmaster, as Dan Turner. And Tracy Scoggins was in it. Gosh, we had Clu Gulager in it. We had Eddie Deason. We had Paul Bartel. It was a great B-picture cast.
Tell us a little about Robert Leslie Bellum and who Dan Turner was. Well, I mean, is he like a Earl Stanley Garner where he wrote a bunch of stories about?
Absolutely. Although he wrote other stories as well. But he adopted a real slangy kind of, S.J. Perlman once wrote an essay, as a matter of fact, called Somewhere a Roscoe, or an essay about Dan Turner, Hollywood detective. And Bellum, that was probably his most famous, even though he was one of those million-word-a-year guys, or 500,000 words a year. They all had different little standards. Dan Turner, Hollywood detective, started in a pulp called Spicy Detective back about 1934, and it ended up being, and he ended up getting his own book called Hollywood Detective, started out Dan Turner, Hollywood Detective, and then he was in Speed Detective, and he was in Private Detective. There was a movie that Republic made with Dan Turner in the late 1940s. And there were probably, as nearly as we can tell, and it's hard to say because there's a lot of retitlings and things, but nearly 300 Dan Turner stories. But you know, there was not one Dan Turner Christmas story. Dan Turner is a Hollywood detective. He works with the studios, and he might say something like, "Behind me, a Roscoe sneezed ka-chee, and a lead pill split the ozone next to my noggin. I ankled a lot, my hip pockets dipping gravel," which would mean someone shot at him and he ran. So it was great fun, since Robert Leslie Bellum had never done a Dan Turner Christmas story. I wrote a Christmas story for the lead story of our book in the style of Robert Leslie Bellum's Dan Turner Hollywood Detective.
How much research do you have to do to understand the lingo? Because, I mean, it really is archaic lingo that is totally gone. Like Public Enemy, the book about Dillinger and all those guys.
Oh, yes.
You know, it brought back the term yeggman, which, yes. You know, yeggman was basically a standard phrase for a bank robber. And that word has gone almost extinct, and I would think a lot of these idioms from the 20s and 30s have gone extinct.
They have, but you know, the thing is, I spend way too much time reading and enjoying this stuff. It's not research for me. I just kind of absorb it because I love these stories. Dan Turner was really kind of the guy that got me into collecting pulps in the first place, because I read a few. I was a comic book collector, and somebody brought some of these in, and I read them. They were just great. And, you know, Bellum actually has some connections to Tulsa, as do many of the pulpsters. Robert Leslie Bellum met and married his wife at the Tulsa Tribune, and in point of fact, he was one of the photographers at the 1921 race riot for the Tulsa Tribune. I found that out in my research when I was researching his life for another compilation of his stories that I did.
So before we actually talk about the stories in the Christmas book, what do you think fueled all this in the 1920s and 30s? Because, you know, it seems like it was this very, very popular, and then it just sort of faded away.
It did, but it always comes back.
Was it because it was so cynical? Maybe it had that veneer of cynicism back when we were more innocent? What do you think?
No, I think if you look at it really, Rich, it flourished between the two world wars. It was after World War I. People generally think, although there's some evidence that indicates something else, but people generally think it started in the 1920s with a character named Race Williams by a writer named Carol John Daly, who was writing in the same pulp, Black Mask, which later on Hammett, just a few months later, Hammett would do the Maltese Falcon. And, of course, Hammett was a much better writer than his predecessor. And so he's the one that kind of gets the credit for starting the hardball genre. And he was an ex-Pinkerton agent, Hammett was, and Carol John Daly wasn't. He was just a guy, you know, and just a writer. So he kind of gets buried sometimes in that. But I know why it went into eclipse in World War II, because in hardboiled detective fiction, a lot of people are always antagonistic toward one another all the time. They're always, if you look at some of the stories like our Inspector Allhoff in this book and our Broadway Squad with Marquis of Broadway story, they're always butting up against each other. They're always yammering. They're always smarting off at each other. When World War II came along,
that was the one time the whole country was unified.
They didn't want that. They didn't want that hardboiled thing of people fighting one another, because we were all fighting the Axis.
Now you brought up Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler earlier. Those are the two names we still remember. Was that because they were just the best stories of this genre?
Well, you know, I mean, there were more Roman playwrights that were real good than Seneca, you know?
But Seneca is the guy.
That's the guy we study, you know. Hammett and Chandler were very different. Hammett was terse, sparse. He was more along the Hemingway lines. He was very direct. Chandler wrote like what he was, a person who'd come up through the school system in England that wanted to show Americans how to live. and how to have sort of, he was very much into the whole
descriptive language.
And the knightly qualities of valor and courtliness, even in this setting. You look at him and you see a lot of King Arthur in Chandler's stories, as strange as that may seem. And plus, he was a master of metaphor and simile. Mm-hmm. Now Hammett was just right. He was just bang, 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 like James M. Cain or Hemingway, you know, just staccato. But Chandler was very different.
Well, like any sort of popular entertainment genre, holidays and Christmas time you always have to do either a Thanksgiving or a Christmas episode.
That's
in
right.
Television today.
That's right.
Was it the same for the hard-boiled detectives?
Well, when John McMahon and I are both Pulp fans, have been Pulp fans for many, many years, John McMahon from here in Tulsa, we have always wanted to do a Pulp collection. And this is from the first book out of our imprint, which is called Reverse Karma Press. And we put this together last year, and I might say also there's a lot of print-on-demand going on, but we didn't do that. We had it printed and bound in Tulsa. Mm-hmm. And so we're very proud of the book, and the reason that we did a Christmas book was because this is a golden age of pulp reprints right now. Just about every story is getting reprinted, and you can't – if you're a pulp fan, the market is truly glutted. We wanted something, A, that was a little bit different – and B, that would appeal to people outside of pulp fandom, which is why, you know, we have an introduction here kind of explaining what the pulps are. We have the same thing on our website. And so we thought maybe this was a good way to enter it by collecting some Christmas stories.
Now, of course, when somebody wants to read a Christmas story, oh, yeah, I think I'd like to read a story about a lurid murder or a kidnapping attempt gone awry.
Yuletide homicide, as we like to say, yeah.
But I guess a lot of these writers, they when December, you know, about June or July when they're planning out the year, I got to write a Christmas story for the December issues.
A lot of times they would. And, you know, they're not that hard. They're not that easy to find. But when you think about it, it makes perfect sense because the hard-boiled detectives, on the one hand, are so cynical and on the other hand, so romantic in a lot of ways in terms of capital R romanticism. The idea of almost being a Christ figure, as Raymond Chandler said about the hard-boiled detective, he needs to be the best man in his world and a good enough man for any world. And that's kind of the way that these guys are. And so it makes sense. And some of the stories in here are very dark, and some of them are very chipper. For instance, there's a character I alluded to earlier, a John Lawrence character named the Marquis of Broadway, who's this tough cop. And, I mean, he's really mean, but he's a softie at Christmas. And because he's a softie at Christmas, that's what propels this particular story. He's too lenient on a real criminal, and then there you go.
Now, I was looking through some of the names, again, there was like a one who's, I believe he has a lieutenant in the first.
Yes. We're not really sure that he was a lieutenant.
Yeah, you're not sure about anything about him.
No,
I mean,
you're
it was like, it sounds like it was a made-up biography.
It's certainly possible they were not above making their biographies a little bit more exciting, because most of them were just guys sitting in a room pounding on a typewriter.
Now, who among the writers that you have in there were actually, you know, writers working under their own name, or did they tend to make, you know, a bunch of writers wrote under the one name?
A lot of times, mostly that was, for instance, with The Shadow or Doc Savage, with when there was
big characters.
And when there was a continuity of when there were continuing characters. A lot of these are one-off stories, so they didn't really need to do that. But if you were doing something like, for instance, David Goodis, who a lot of people are celebrating now as one of the real dark paperback original guys, really one of the great guys, he would write whole issues of air war pulps. There were actually air pulps and air war pulps.
Air war?
Yeah, air war. Fighting.
Fighters. Okay,
airplanes
right.
in one war or another. He would write the whole issue. And so he had to use different names. But the guys that we have in this book, we know were real people. And some of them would write under pseudonyms. Bellum wrote under, I think he had, I tried to run down his pseudonyms one time. I think Robert Leslie Bellum had something like 50, 75 pseudonyms.
Wow.
That he would do.
Was it because he didn't think, was it in some cases because he was afraid that, oh, we've already had a Bellum last month?
He was so prolific. And maybe in a Hollywood detective, he'd write a Dan Turner story, and then he'd write one. There was another detective he had called Little Jack Horner that was a Hollywood detective. And so he'd write him under another name. And so it wouldn't look like he was just writing the whole thing.
So who are some of the most interesting pulp fiction writers here in this collection?
Well, I really have always liked John K. Butler, and he was a guy, he wrote for the major pulps. Black Mask and Dime Detective were really the two big hard-boiled pulps. John K. Butler did characters like Lonergan of Frisco, and he had Steve Midnight, the hard luck hacker who was a taxi cab driver that was always getting into all kinds of trouble. And his story in this one is in Hard-Boiled Christmas Stories is not a series story, but it sure shows he was the guy that could balance that sentimentality with toughness better than just about anybody. Another one, I think, is Steve Fisher. And Steve Fisher is kind of well known to aficionados, mystery aficionados, because he wrote I Wake Up Screaming, that great book that was reissued by Black Lizard and was also a big MGM or 20th Century Fox movie with Betty Grable. And he writes a second-person story in here that's set in Hollywood that is just nuts. It's just very, very strange. John Lawrence, a Canadian, is another one who has the marquee of Broadway, as I said, was a great. These guys were right below Hammett and Chandler, but they're forgotten today.
My guest today is John Woolley, our specialist on esoterica. He's the host of Swing on This, our Western Swing show here on Public Radio, but he's also a wonderful writer and a collector of all sorts of memorabilia in the horror genre, B-movies, and the Hard-Boiled Detective. And
right.
He and John McMahon have created a book, Hard-Boiled Christmas Stories, featuring 10 stories with a Christmas theme from the hard-boiled tradition with an original story. This book actually was published right before Christmas last year, but it came out so late that this is the launch.
The launch. We had a small batch come out late last year, and what's so gratifying, Rich, is that a lot of the people who are buying it are not pulp fans. And so we wanted to make this kind of, they don't know, maybe they don't even know what a pulp is, but they understand the concept of hard-boiled and Christmas, and it amuses them.
It is amusing. I was struck by something you mentioned earlier, was that one of the writers you mentioned wrote for Spicy Detective.
Yes.
And really, a lot of these were kind of lurid in their day, weren't they?
Some were. Spicy Detective, as a matter of fact, was banned in New York at one point by LaGuardia.
Now, of course, when you read all these stories, they're so innocent.
They're pretty innocent. Now, some of the spicy stuff could get a little spicy.
Uh-huh.
They had Spicy Detective, Spicy Mystery, Spicy Western, and Spicy
Adventure. But in general, this genre was something, it wasn't approved reading material probably in its day, was it?
It depends. Some of it, The Shadow, Doc Savage, Tarzan came out of the pulps, of course. Mm-hmm. Zorro came out of the pulps. And yeah, it was, but some of it was more, like anything else, like I guess comic books today might be a good analogy. Some are more adult than others. Something like Doc Savage, kids loved him, or Secret Agent X, or G8 and his Battle Aces, But you get into the hard-boiled stuff, it's a little more sophisticated, and they were really setting the template for the hard-boiled detective was invented. It's one of our few literary inventions in America. But if you ever try and see, and the way you know that, if you ever try and see somebody from overseas try hard-boiled detectives, they just don't quite get it. Somebody like James Hadley Chase, they're just almost goofy because it's, not that these aren't, but, they don't really get the genre and the milieu, I guess.
And you mentioned the word template. Is there a template for a hard-boiled detective story? What is the template?
The template is just what Raymond Chandler wrote a lot about this. He wrote essays, "The Down These Mean Streets a Man Must Go, Who Is Himself Neither Mean Nor Afraid," all this. The template is I don't want to get all grad school on you, but he's essentially a Christ figure. He is the only hope in a dark world. People put their hope.
And that dark world may be a neighborhood. It may be a whole city. It may be the wrong side of the tracks.
Generally, it's urban. Generally, yeah. It's the neon wilderness, as they like to do, the dark underbelly of the city. And here comes this. He's hired. A private detective is always hired by somebody to unravel some sort of mystery. And he is the symbol of hope. He is the Christ figure. And he's.
And there has to be a moment of desolation where utter loss. You know, this is going to be a loss.
Unless, of course, it's Dan Turner, and he never loses anything. Dan Turner.
Well, there's a moment, but then I guess it always has to resolve.
Always has to be resolved. And I don't really necessarily need to get off on this, but I have argued for years this is what makes Chinatown not a good film, because Roman Polanski took the original script and changed the ending where there was no hope left. There always has to be hope in a hardball detective story, and there's no hope at the end of Chinatown.
Interesting. Yeah. Now, I guess the rest of the film fans are just missing the boat on this.
Well, you know, I will say I'm in the minority on this, but I've always said it's like changing the last letter in a word. It affects everything that comes before it.
Right. Well, interesting. And so what are some of the other conventions that we always have to have?
Well, you always have to have girls, generally, and they, have to be pretty good looking.
Girls who become angels or fallen angels.
Or vice versa. Yeah. You look at something like The Big Sleep, and you've got all kinds of different ones in that, And then you get into film noir, and that's a whole the whole movies thing being affected by
now is that is that come out of the hardboiled detective?
It does, but it comes a little later. The film noir after World War II. When the hard it's kind of almost it's almost they take the hardboiled detective and make it even more cynical, and then you jump to Spillane, who takes the hardboiled detective with Mike Hammer. And it becomes much more bloody, much more violent, much more, he's much less of a figure of hope, and much more of a kind of a vigilante. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how it metamorphosed from the 20s, 30s, and 40s into the 50s.
And does it sort of mold into the mystery genre at some point?
It does. It's not, it's not the polite, ratiocinative mystery, if you will. It's not Sherlock Holmes, and it's not really, it's not really even Philo Vance. They tend to solve things more with their fists and with their dogged determinism than by sitting like Poe's Dupin
using their noggin.
As
the Pulps would say.
Yeah, they use their noggin. Is it the purloined letter that Dupin doesn't even leave his room and solves the crime? They don't do that. They have to get out there and mix it up and get knocked around and knock a few people around and then get it done.
Now, the name of the book is Hardboiled Christmas Stories, edited by my guest today, John Woolley and John McMahon, and features a new story, Santa's Sleigh Ride in the Dan Turner style.
Yeah, that's S-L-A-Y.
Yes, of course.
We might tell your listeners.
Yeah.
Of course it is.
Yes. And I assume those are a hoot to write.
Oh, I had so much fun doing that.
It is literally filled with idiomatic phrases from the 20s and 30s. I mean, I think you'd have to have like a slang dictionary to write the thing.
Well, and some that were even weird in the 20s and 30s, or in this case in the 30s, Bellum started in 34. He used the term "fernenced" all the time, which
fernenced.
You never see.
What is "fernenced"?
He said he had a gun fernenced by noggin, and it just simply means up against, and it's a real word. But I don't know that "fernenced" was ever used a lot in America, but he uses "fernenced" all of the time in the Dan Turner stories, and so I used it in mine.
All right. Well, we wish you great success with Hardboiled Christmas Stories. If you're looking for something offbeat, well, this certainly is off the beaten path. John Woolley, as always, it's a pleasure.
Rich, thank you so much.
John Woolley is our guest today on Studio Tulsa. He is the co-editor, along with John McMahon, of the new collection Hardboiled Christmas Stories. Booksmart Tulsa will host a reading and signing for the book by a guy who scraped gum off his shoes one time too many, if you know what I mean, tonight in the heart of the city at 7 o'clock at Dwelling Spaces. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Thank you. Here's the comments of Colin Hines here on Studio Tulsa.
Back in November 2012, a monument with the Ten Commandments inscribed on it was unveiled on the lawn outside the Oklahoma State Capitol. For Mike Ritz, an Oklahoma lawmaker from Broken Arrow, whose family put up the funds for the $10,000 monument, it was a perfect day, except that there were two misspelled words on the monument. The errors were quickly fixed, and there the monument has stood quietly, garnering little attention ever since, until now. A satanic group from New York, where else, has recently come forward, and they want a monument at the state capitol that pays homage to the Prince of Darkness. Oklahoma lawmakers are not amused. Representative Earl Sears told media outlets, quote, "This is a faith-based state. I think it is very offensive they would contemplate or even have this kind of conversation," unquote. Representative Earl Proctor pointed out, quote, "It is not something the people of Oklahoma would support, and the people of Oklahoma support the Ten Commandments monument," unquote. Representative Doug Cox warned, quote, "It is not going to get approved here without a court battle," unquote. As all God-fearing Oklahomans must know, wherever Lucifer's hooves tread, the American Civil Liberties Union cannot be far behind. Ryan Kiesel, the ACLU of Oklahoma executive director, has said, quote, "If at the end of the day, the Ten Commandments monument is allowed to remain on the Capitol grounds with its overtly Christian message, then the Satanic Temple's proposal can't be rejected because it is of a different religious viewpoint," unquote. This is all a lot of fun for a couple of reasons. The whole matter exposes the irony deficiency some Oklahoma lawmakers suffer from. Also, it teaches us something about civics. Under the constitutional concept of separation of church and state, the government, at any level, state or federal, is prohibited from endorsing any one particular religion. This is what ensures the freedom of individuals to follow and practice any faith they want, or even to have no faith at all. If the Ten Commandment folks at the state capitol want to have their monument, then everyone should get to have one. Not long after the Satanists made their devilish intentions known, the Universal Society of Hinduism came forward to announce that they want to erect a statue in honor of the Hindu deity Lord Hanuman, who has a body built like a pro wrestler, a long, handsome tail, and the face of a monkey. Rajan Zed, the president of the Hindu group, said that Lord Hanuman is particularly revered for his strength and for being a perfect grammarian. It sounds like whoever originally carved the Ten Commandments into that monument at the state capitol could have used a little of Hanuman's mojo. So it now seems that the gates to transcendent realms have been kicked wide open. Now every religion, tradition, and faith might come clamoring to claim some turf at the Oklahoma state capitol on which to build a monument honoring their particular god, gods, deities, demons, or sacred scriptures. A Mecca in the heartland. What's not to love? The State Department of Tourism should be all over this.
Colin Hines is a local writer, an attorney, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. He blogs at Carpe Absurdum. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you miss one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just search for Studio Tulsa and you can look for our archives through past programs. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.